I'd like to thank the Dutch Academy very much for this honor and the invitation. And when I heard about the movie, I was a little bit nervous because I was afraid of being embarrassed. But, well, first of all, thank you for basing the movie on a younger version of Edward Witten. That was very thoughtful. secondly, when I watched the movie, some things I said I felt probably hold up well today. Unfortunately, some things are things that I was going to say today, so you will have heard them twice. And even the things that I said in the movie that perhaps won't hold up very well, I thought were said nicely, so I didn't mind hearing them. So my original plan when I was asked to give this talk was to sort of survey the last generation and a half in string theory, talking about three periods where string theory outgrew its inventors, where it turned out that the interpretation of the theory was not what was foreseen by those who started it. That when the theory was developed, it turned out that it forced upon its developers and creators a different interpretation than what was originally envisaged. I had a little bit of a trouble squeezing that into 20 minutes, so I'm kind of only going to be doing 2.5, which is, I don't really have time to explain what was the original point of view when string theory was invented, starting in the late 60s, as a possible theory of strong interactions, and we'll kind of have to jump ahead to what emerged from that very creative period. So, as I said, I'll be explaining a little bit how our views of string theory have changed over the years, with an emphasis on how the theory forced us to change from what we thought when we here means collectively, including periods when I wasn't involved, when we were developing it. So it's been a long process that started in 1968, and unfortunately, because of the limited time, I'll start the process beginning in the early 80s, which is roughly where I started to join the field. Though by that time, a lot of things had already happened. Now, there's actually a simple picture, which was in the movie, or a version of it was in the movie, that gives insight into a lot of the surprises in string theory. And this picture has to do with how Feynman diagrams, which are the traditional way to describe elementary particle interactions, change when we go to string theory. So I've drawn on the left a Feynman diagram as visualized by Feynman. And remember, he did not start with the textbook recipes that involve Fourier transforms and very convenient formulas for integrals in momentum space. He started with the picture of particles propagating in space-time. They were allowed to go on any possible path, so it's okay that these are not perfectly straight lines, but a little bit wiggly. And then there are space-time events that I've labeled as Z, X, Y, and W, where one particle branched into two, or two recombine into one. And what's depicted here is what's called a one-loop contribution to a process where two particles came in the past and two go out in the future. Now, I've drawn the same thing on the right for strings instead of particles. So now, at each time, we have a little loop of string. I've chosen the example of a closed string. As time goes on, the string moves in space-time, so it sweeps out a two-dimensional tube. But in string theory, these tubes are smoothly joined. So this picture, if you look at it from a big distance, looks a lot like this one, but the details are rather different. The biggest difference being that in the traditional picture, there are definite space-time events where something happens, but in the string picture, if you look closely, any small piece is like any other. So this statement is actually what I just told you. The interaction vertices of the Feynman diagrams, which are these events where something happened in quantum field theory, disappear when we go to string theory. So I want to stress that the inventors of the theory didn't have that picture at all. They didn't have in mind the string picture. It started with Vinatsarada writing down an amplitude that was supposed to describe hadron resonances. But once this picture was invented, it had a lot of implications. The first is that the infinities of Feynman diagrams disappear. The infinities of Feynman diagrams have to do with what happens when the different interaction vertices all coincide in space-time. Now there are no interaction vertices and no infinities. There's no definite notion of a space-time event. The interaction vertex is the prototype in traditional quantum field theory of the space-time event where something happens. In going to string theory, this is the beginning of the fact that the notion of space-time event is kind of fuzzed out. There's some new version of space-time, which will have to replace it. And what the interactions are going to be is not up to us. They're fixed once we pick the string. You see, in the Feynman picture, even once you've decided what the particle is, it's up to you to decide what kind of branching processes are allowed. Those are the vertices in the Feynman diagram, and they depend upon your choice of a quantum field theory. Even once you've decided that you have electrons and photons, you have different choices for how they might interact. Quantum electrodynamics is based on the simplest possible choice, but we could, if we wished, add higher interactions. In the string picture, once we've picked the string, the interactions are determined because every small piece of the picture is the same as any other. So the interactions are not up to us. There will be a definite outcome. We don't have any choice of what the interactions will be. And when one calculates, one finds out that the interactions are those of general relativity, with corrections at short distances that preserve the general structure of Einstein's theory. Now, we've got a very high confidence in this statement because the physicists in whose formulas it first appeared in the early 70s didn't like it. Dozens or hundreds of papers were written to try to get rid of this result by physicists who intended to apply the theory to the strong interactions and were not trying to make a theory that would describe general relativity. But the theory forced the interpretation upon the physicists developing it. It wanted to describe general relativity. Of course, general relativity is Einstein's theory of gravity. And its emergence here is a big deal because, as far as we understand, in standard quantum field theory, it's not possible to describe quantum gravity. You run into uncontrollable infinities. While instead, string theory forces quantum gravity upon us. And that's the biggest single reason for the interest in the theory since this point came to be appreciated in the 70s, which I remind you was before I was working in the field. Now, general relativity involves the dynamics of space-time. And the last two points I made, one was that there was, in string theory, no definite notion of a space-time event. And the second was that it forces general relativity upon us. Those two facts should go together because a quantum theory of gravity should force us to rethink our concepts of space-time. So these two facts, which both came from the disappearance of the interaction vertex when you replace Feynman diagrams by string diagrams, it's natural that they should go together. Now, what I've just described is the outcome of the first big change in perspective in the theory. It's a much bigger thing than anyone aimed for when the string theory started. Given more time, I would tell you more about what the original perspective was. But at any rate, the perspective of 1968 involved a brilliant but ultimately not completely successful attempt to describe the strong interactions. So developing the theory, physicists were forced to aim for something much bigger, a theory that would describe quantum gravity and a new concept of space-time. So this was not the first time and not the last time that understanding that string theory forced gravity upon us was neither the first nor the last time that the development of the theory forced a major rethinking of what it meant. So now I'll move on to describe a second episode where developing the theory forced physicists to change their point of view of what it meant. If we go back to the period when I became active in the 80s, the prevailing view was that string theory entailed two major deformations of pre-20th century physics. Well, there's one that we're all familiar with and was developed in the early part of the century. That's the familiar deformation involving H-bar, the Planck's constant, involving the work of the first Lorentz medalist, as we were just reminded. But in string theory, there's a second deformation involving a stringy length scale that traditionally is called alpha prime, below which traditional ideas in geometry are modified. So H-bar drastically changes what mechanics means, replacing classical mechanics by quantum mechanics, and alpha prime changes ideas in geometry, replacing general relativity based on Riemannian geometry, with a new kind of geometry. So, what is the new geometry? So it's some kind of stringy modification of ordinary ideas in geometry that makes quantum gravity inevitable rather than impossible. So it's a question that was raised by string theory work in the 70s, but it was largely neglected for some years. It was largely neglected until 1984, when a new method of anomaly cancellation and a new string theory that was developed made it possible to derive from string theory a decent rough draft of the real world. So before 1984, as a slightly academic matter, string theorists had what looked like consistent theories of quantum gravity unified with matter, but the matter appeared to be wrong. After 1984, there was a major advance in the matter looking much more realistic, and then it became more popular, well, string theory as a whole, and in particular this question of what was the new kind of stringy geometry. So most string theorists, including me, spent the decade after 1984 largely studying the alpha prime deformation. After all, the H-bar deformation was intensively studied since the beginning of quantum mechanics. The alpha prime deformation was much more novel. The prevailing view of the period was that the new geometry was something that was new, even classically, and if one knew what it was, one would then turn on H-bar in a normal way, just as you in other theories like quantum chromodynamics, the theory of strong interactions. So typical results of that period involve showing that in the new form of geometry, things can happen that can't happen in the type of geometry Einstein used. So I've drawn a picture, but I don't have time to explain it. It's a picture of a change in topology where one space-time is converted into another in a way that you can describe in string theory, but you'd produce a black hole singularity if you tried to do it in general relativity. So that's the kind of things we studied during that decade. What was seen as the main tool of the period was two-dimensional conformal field theory, which describes the motion of a string. It was seen as the best tool for studying the alpha prime deformation of standard geometry. So it seemed like two-dimensional conformal field theory was the important branch of quantum field theory for string theorists. I remember feeling a little wistful about this because I'd spent the earlier part of my career studying more general varieties of quantum field theory, starting with the four-dimensional case, of course, which describes standard particle physics. So this kind of frustrated me, but I can't remember ever channeling this frustration into trying to improve on the then prevailing paradigm. A few physicists did try to go beyond it. They started with a simple question, why stop at strings, why not membranes? If you replace a point particle by a string, maybe you should replace the string by a two-dimensional surface or a membrane, which I tried to draw, but not very successfully there, perhaps. If you take the question literally, why not membranes, it actually has a good answer. Strings work better than membranes or other objects of higher dimensions because of the unique properties of complex numbers. A complex number is made from two real numbers rather than some other number, and just two real numbers have unique properties, and strings are based on that. So that's an answer. It's even a good answer. It just didn't prove to be the whole story. Eventually, there was a more subtle version of the membrane picture, and now we know that membranes are actually part of string theory, not an alternative theory, but part of the same theory. Meanwhile, another idea was developing that also proved to challenge the established paradigm. This was duality between electricity and magnetism, an idea that certainly goes back to the days of Lorentz. Since the 19th century, physicists were fascinated by the symmetry of Maxwell's equations in vacuum between electric and magnetic fields. Quantum mechanically, such a symmetry would have to be very subtle because Dirac showed that if you had both electric and magnetic charges, they would be related by a quantum mechanical formula that involves Planck's constant. Among other things, that says that they can't both be very small. And since quantum theory is hard to understand when the charges aren't small, it says that we're going to have trouble understanding how there can be a symmetry between electric and magnetic charge. So it took a long time for physicists to make sense of quantum electric magnetic duality and to learn to use it. But this was happening by the 90s. Now, if a symmetry that exchanges electricity and magnetism is going to be important in a theory, then because of the H-bar in Dirac's formula, that's a symmetry that only will make sense quantum mechanically. It won't have a standard classical limit. So, up to this time, as I told you, the prevailing paradigm was that the stringy deformation made sense by itself and you would quantize it afterwards. The main change in the point of view in the 90s was that physicists learned to treat alpha prime and H-bar together. And when that was done, it turned out to lead to a nice surprise. It turns out that there's only one string theory, which is only one candidate for superunification of the laws of nature. There's another nice picture that illustrates it. This is a two-dimensional plot, where roughly speaking, the two parameters are the two types of deformation, alpha prime and H-bar. When you view, when you try to take the classical limit, traditionally there seem to be five string theories, which have been placed at corners of this picture. There's another limit that involves 11-dimensional supergravity. It's not a string theory, but it belongs in the same picture. And the conception that emerged in the 90s is that there's a more unified theory that involves both of these deformations, alpha prime and H bar, that should be treated together. And the traditional string theories emerge in different ways to take the classical limit. The reason there are different ways to take the classical limit is, roughly speaking, that there are different ways to take one parameter out of the two parameters and call it H bar. So the previous paradigm is that string theory is based on two-dimensional conformal field theory. The new point of view that emerged in the 90s is that all quantum field theory in all dimensions is part of the input for string theory. So whatever one might have learned in an earlier part of one's career about any aspect of quantum field theory is useful somehow. For example, gauge theory with UN gauge group, which you could think of as being more or less the gauge symmetry of the standard model, in any dimension, describes the behavior of N parallel brains. Here I've drawn three brains. Brain is a generalization of membrane. Membrane is two-dimensional. That's actually what's drawn here, just because it's easiest to draw. But the N-dimensional case is what people call brains. But anyway, gauge theory in any dimension is used to describe the behavior of brains. So the new conception, where H-bar and alpha prime are treated together, and all quantum field theory is part of the input for string theory, has lots of applications. I'll just mention two of them. One is a better understanding of the quantum mechanics of black holes, and the other is a better understanding of the four-dimensional gauge theory that's used in the standard model of particle physics. These are both done in roughly the same way. You build a black hole out of brains, and then you use gauge theory on the brains to describe the black hole. Then you build a dictionary between black holes and gauge theory, and whenever a question can be answered on one side, you translate it to an improved understanding on the other side. So, in sum, in the 90s, the prevailing view of what string theory means and how one has to try to understand it was greatly enlarged again. So you might ask, what's next? What might be the next major change in perspective? Now, it's famously hard to make predictions, especially about the future. That's a remark that's due to a prominent American baseball player, but I realize neither the individual nor the remark might be as famous in this country as they are in the U.S. But we're actually dealing here with a case about which it's not just difficult to make predictions about the future. It's a little difficult to know what to say about the recent past. There's possibly been another major change in the interpretation of the theory in roughly the last decade, but it's hard to know for sure. By the way, I recommend lectures of my Dutch colleague, Professor Schellekens, for more on what I will very briefly explain. And in this movie, at the end of it, I gave a very articulate statement of a viewpoint that was very opposed to what I'm about to tell you. So I wish I knew when that interview was filmed. I didn't realize I'd ever gone on record with such a clear statement of what was my views in that period, because I didn't remember the interview, and I never wrote it in a paper. So it was amusing to watch the interview for me. Well, since there's only one string theory, you might hope that it might have only one quantum vacuum describing our universe and leading to definite predictions for the values of all the dimensionless natural constants. That was the view that was behind what I was saying in the last part of the interview. But research in string theory has actually never supported this hope. For example, going back to the 1980s, models of string compactification to four dimensions, when the techniques were available to get something like the standard model, that was great, but it was found that there was not one possibility, but many that were at least roughly compatible with what we observe. I always hoped this would go away, but later research just had the effect of generating more possibilities. Now, I was one of the people working on these constructions, and I'm tempted to say that the proliferation of possibilities was the embarrassment of my youth. But meanwhile, developments in astronomy have made some of our most distinguished colleagues not particularly motivated by string theory, including one of whom was shown on that movie, Steve Weinberg, suspect that the real world might be based not on a unique possibility, but on such a megaverse of possibilities. The two most relevant developments pointing in this direction are the observation of the apparent observation of a tiny but not zero cosmological constant, and the success of the theory of cosmic inflation in describing the fluctuations of the cosmic microwave radiation. The first suggests that there might be a need for a theory that develops many possible outcomes, and the second gives a way to populate in different and separately enormous parts of the universe regions of space-time that realize different outcomes. So if the landscape of string vacua is the right concept in describing the real universe, it's another big shift in our interpretation of the theory, which certainly wasn't foreseen, by most of us who were originally stumbling upon the fact that there were too many solutions. It certainly isn't what I was aiming for in working on compactification in the 80s. This process has a long way still to run. Again, as I said in the movie, we're not particularly close to seeing the end of it. Thank you.